Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. Day one, and I'll ask you to read, if you would, starting with you, Sissel, and going down the line, taking a paragraph or a verse each.
One day, Shito said to the layman, "Since seeing me, what have your daily activities been?" The layman replied, "If you're asking what I do every day, there's nothing to say about it. What did you think you were doing before I asked you about it?" And the layman offered this verse.
"My daily activities are not unusual. I'm just naturally in harmony with them. Grasping nothing, discarding nothing. In every place there's no hindrance, no conflict. Who assigns the ranks of vermilion and purple? The hills and the mountains, last speck of dust is extinguished. My supernatural power and marvelous activity, drawing water and carrying firewood."
During the Guanho era, 806 to 820, the layman traveled northward to Sanghan, stopping here and there. His daughter Ling Chao sold bamboo baskets for their morning and evening meals. The layman had these verses, which say,
"When the mind's as is, circumstances also are as is. There's no real and also no unreal. Giving no heed to existence and holding not to non-existence. We are neither saint nor sage, just an ordinary man who has settled his affairs.
To preserve your life, you must destroy it. Having completely destroyed it, you dwell at ease. When you attain the inmost meaning of this, an iron boat floats upon the water."
Thank you. The Buddha, who set this practice of ours in motion so long ago, I'm particularly aware now because we've been studying it in a study group. He was careful and diligent in his practice. He really worked hard at it. He carefully studied his own body and his own mind. I think it's fair to say that his primary practice was our primary practice, present moment awareness, he called it. We call it Zazen. Present moment awareness, which he cultivated with his breathing, like we do. And using this tool of present moment awareness, he saw more and more subtly into his own mind and into the nature of reality. And how to some degree, relieve what he saw as the subtle and persistent unease that we all feel. So after years of this study, careful study and also rather austere study, he relaxed a little bit and sat in meditation for a week under the Bodhi tree. And after that, on the seventh day, he saw the morning star and had an awakening to the way things are. In the Zen tradition, we say his first words were, "All beings are already enlightened. They just don't see it. They just don't recognize it. It's merely a matter of recognition. They just don't realize it." It's a very long just, but that's the problem. We don't see it. Buddha almost certainly did not say that. But we like to believe that he did in the Zen school. We put that into his mouth. However, I don't doubt that he believed something like it. We put it there because it's so important from the Zen point of view to recognize that you and I can recognize the same thing, can see the same thing that the Buddha did, can discover the same thing. Whether a man or a woman, whether rich or poor, whether lay or monk, we can realize our own intrinsic, already enlightened state. We can do it. And we do it with this present moment awareness. And with that present moment awareness and breathing, we can relieve some of our unease. The Buddha felt that. And he stood up after his awakening experience. First, he just wanted to keep sitting there. But then he heard the phone ringing, and he realized he had to get up and answer the call to help all beings, to educate them. So he got up and he found the four mendicants that he had left, and he taught them. That was the first turning of the wheel. And then he gave him a rough ordination, kind of field ordination. And there they were, the five of them were the first monks. The sixth one was interesting. There's a story about the sixth monk. He was the child of wealthy parents, like the Buddha was, who had, like the Buddha, become disgusted with the luxuries and the pleasures of his home life. And he ran away from home and found the Buddha early on. He'd heard about him. So he found the Buddha. And the Buddha ordained him, but his mother and father were close behind. And they caught up. But when they saw how wonderful the Buddha was and the cohort of people around him, his friends, they were so moved that they became the Buddha's first lay disciples, and they took refuge in the Buddha Dharma and Sangha. From that time on, the honest truth is there are not that many lay people that show up in the story. Master after master after master after master, not so many lay people. Some exceptions: Vimalakirti, the rich lay person who bested all the monks, King Ashoka, and then finally the penniless Pang family. And that's who we're going to talk about today. The stories that I'm sharing from the Pang family are set in China in the 700s. This is the, what did it say? It said 800s, didn't it, in our reading? Yeah, early 800s, so late 700s. This is the golden age of Zen, runs from about 700 to 900. And there are just hundreds of stories and characters and scores of collections. And only one of those is about a layperson that I know of. And that's this one, the layman, the record of layman Peng. It includes stories also not only of layman Peng, but of his accomplished wife and his daughter Ling Chao. He had a son, but we don't know what happened to the son. He didn't seem to be as interested in the Dharma. And this Pang family remained the most famous Zen lay people for 1,000 years. Zen has been, an overwhelmingly monastic tradition until the last 50 years in the West. And we're now amidst a historic change in which lay people and lay teachers, again, at least in the West, have not only been accepted but also dominant in this in America and Europe. I chose the Pangs because they are lay people like you and me, and also because they are male and female like you and me. It's also true that there aren't that many female voices in the Zen tradition. I've been looking for them. Last spring, Kenko and I talked about some of them. In the years to come, I want to do more of that. So, the Pang family are painted as accomplished practitioners, and they, you'll see in these stories, they get the better of Zen masters and monks. Not only Layman Pang, but also his wife and daughter. You may remember, those of you who came to the spring retreat, there was this one sweet scene in Yuiki's Yi Kui's life. This is in the 1600s in China, where she is chanting. This is before she gets ordained. She's chanting with her mother and her brother in their home, and the sound of the chanting wafts through the neighborhood, and it draws more people to them, and they more and more people come, and the record says they were just like the Pang family, those guys. It was so beautiful to see. Layman Pang was born in the mid-700s in China, and he was clever. He was a successful merchant, made a lot of money. Then the record says he became concerned about the nature of the human condition and sought to understand the reality of it. He became concerned about the nature of the human condition and sought to understand the reality of it. Something must have stirred him. Something must have jolted him off of his, worldly successful path. He had a comfortable life. He had a stable life. But he also had a growing urge to understand. That urge that brings us here, I think, each one of us. So after practicing for some time, Lama Pang got really serious and famously loaded all of his possessions onto a boat and pushed it out, or rowed it out to the middle of the lake and scuttled it. So everything went down to the bottom of the lake. Doesn't say whether he checked with his wife about this plan before doing it, but she was a serious practitioner as well. So she may have not been too worried about it. During his travels, he met this fellow who shows up in the first case, Master Shitu had studied with Huineng, the sixth patriarch, so that's kind of the era we're talking about, really just at the beginning of the golden era. And when he was a young monk, he studied with Huineng. His name means stone head, because he lived in a hut, a grass hut that was built on a large rock. So they called him Stonehead. And he was one of two of the great Zen masters of his day. They said sort of the two heads of the lake or something. I think they lived on two sides of this lake. The other one was Matsu, or Baso in Japanese. And that was Hyakujo's teacher, for those of you who keep track of these things. And there's lots of stories about Matsu. He was very outgoing and prolific. She too liked the quieter life. He was the quieter of these two monks. Layman Pang studied with both of them. But since she too shows up in this story, I thought I would read to you his most famous poem, or parts of it. It's called Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage, and it gives you a feeling for him. Somewhere I saw, I'm looking through chant books, you know, we're redoing ours. Somewhere I saw this poem was in a chant book. I don't know where it was. Maybe it was Great Vow. I thought, wow, I really like this. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'll read. It starts this way. I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. And then he has instructions at the end of this poem. He says, let go of hundreds of years and relax. Let go of hundreds of years and relax. Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations, are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. So that's a little feeling for him. And you can hear an echo of Shitu, I think, in Layman Pang. Okay, let's look at the reading. The layman... you know, he loved visiting. He was a social guy. He loved visiting people. And he visited Shitu frequently. And in this reading, Shitu comes over and says, what you been doing? And the layman says, what I do every day. There's nothing to say about it. Now, maybe Pang was being evasive here. It's hard to read these things or know exactly what they mean, but maybe he's being evasive, or maybe she too thinks he's being evasive, because he says, okay, I mean, I can imagine him he says, okay, what did you think you were doing before I asked you? That makes me think, okay, so before you gave that artificial answer to a Zen master, what did you think you were doing? Before you were trying to be smart, what did you think you were doing? But Layman Pang comes back with his most famous verse, and he sticks with it. He says, you know, I really hadn't been doing anything. I really hadn't been doing nothing special. But not doing something special in the way that is kind of wonderful. Not doing something special in a very special way. He'd learn to do that, I think. He says, my daily activities are not unusual. They're nothing special. They really aren't. I'm just in harmony with them. No grasping and no rejecting. And when we're like this, when we're not grasping or not rejecting things, there isn't hindrance. There isn't hindrance or conflict in our lives. That sounds pretty good, Mr. Pang. I think, though, it may be somewhat idealized to imagine a life without conflict, without hindrance. I think it points to a direction that we can follow in this practice. In harmony with daily activities means to me, when walking, walk. When eating, eat. When opening a door, open the door. When brushing your teeth, brush your teeth. Inhabit your life with your whole body, this skin bag. That's where we start. Don't get lost. Inhabit your life. Once in a while, when you're driving, turn off the radio. Just drive. When you're working, sometimes take out your earbuds and stop getting smart. Try to be with the events in your life. And then that's as difficult as it is, it's easier with simple events and pleasant ones. It's more difficult with unpleasant ones. I mean, we're sitting here, it's warm, we go outside, it's a little bit cool. Just inhabit that. I remember so well at Mount Baldy how it was in a warm Zendo and freezing cold outside with the wind howling, and just girding myself, at first girding myself, and then realizing, okay, I just have to do this now. That's really good practice, just to do the next thing. So when you're given an assignment and it's the toilets, just do that activity. Don't worry about it. Inhabit that fully, as fully as you can. And that's one of the great things about doing different kinds of activities. Mostly fine in a retreat like this, but always changing. Not always the way I would want it if I was doing it myself. And then, you see, if we can learn to inhabit our body, inhabit our lives, when we have difficulty with a family, or we lose a position, or we make a mistake with a friend, or we make a mistake in the Zendo, we can harmonize more easily with that situation. We can inhabit that situation more readily. The difficult one, the painful one. It's not just about ease. It's also about inhabiting those more difficult places. Okay, that happened. That difficult thing happened. The Jigiditsu let us out in the rain. Why did she do that? I don't know, but here we are. And now that's a part of me. So, yeah, and there's no avoiding that. And we have to decide what to do next sometimes, but to accept that this is a part of me is an important part of our practice. And the Buddha, when we were just studying the Buddha, he was talking about recognizing the things in your own mind, recognizing laziness as well as attentiveness, recognizing the good and the bad, the kleshas and the lack of the kleshas, that is to say, the, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion. And in that way, if we can inhabit our lives, if we can be with those things, we grow larger. That's the way I put it. We become larger. And maybe, like she too says, everything's in our grass hut. Everything's under our roof. There's nothing that's not under our roof. And I think even with conflict, we can start to approach that differently, being unafraid of it, being accepting with that too. So, then he says, who assigns the ranks of vermilion and purple? This is a couple of strange lines here. The hills and the mountains' last speck of dust is extinguished, especially that one. Who assigns these ranks, anyway, of, you know, of better and worse? I think of those as those, you know, colors as ranks. And he's saying they're empty after all. And just like Master Rinzai says, the true person is the person of no rank. To realize that underneath all these ranks is no rank. And then he says, the hills and the mountains, last speck of dust is extinguished. And the note that I read on this that made sense was that the hills and the mountains, somehow, if you can get your mind around this, I guess maybe the speck of dust is defilements or something, I don't know, but are naturally noble, you see. They don't need anything added to them. They're naturally noble. And then he gets to his most famous line here. What is my supernatural activity? Drawing water and carrying wood. So he says, you know, to be present in your daily activities. This is a superpower, he says. And I think practice has an effect, or can have an effect, of reordering our lives to see this as a superpower, to feel that. It's a bottom-up revolution. Where the new order has these minor acts having value, not the major ones that we have in our minds. So chopping vegetables and vacuuming and washing the dishes and driving and washing our hands, even simply breathing. These have value in and of themselves, these things that we overlook all the time. They're marvelous activities. And, you know, and that is a power that you gain from this practice. To be able to do the simple acts of your life fully. And to have that be enough when you're washing dishes, just to have the activity of washing dishes be enough. You and I can become people who readily, more readily, appreciate those marvelous acts, rather than always pining for more. Just to appreciate that. But in order to do that, we have to give something up. And that's where the second poem comes in. So he says, when the mind is calm, circumstances are as they are. Circumstances also are as is. That is to say, when the mind is calm, circumstances just are as they are. And we're always bending circumstances. We're always manipulating circumstances. And that's what it is to be human, to do that. There's nothing wrong with it, except that we can't stop doing it. We just are compelled to come up with new ways of doing things, to dream, to think up a new circumstance. And this practice insists that we learn to calm our mind and see circumstances just as they are and be okay with that. And in that moment, there's no real and there's also no not real. And I would argue that there's actually both of those at the same time going on, both the real and the not real, depending on what you call real and not real. The underlying truth and the sort of truth, the what the Buddha called the unfabricated and the fabricated, both of those exist at the same time, as do existence and non-existence, self and no self. And we don't have to cling to either. We know both. And then you're neither a sage, neither a saint nor a sage, just an ordinary man who settled his affairs. Rinzai calls this person a person with nothing to do. And here he gets to the heart of it, I think. He says, to preserve your life, and this is kind of, you know, okay, we're talking about marvelous activities and supernatural power. Well, this is how you get it. This is the practice. To preserve your life, you must destroy it. Or as another great sage said, you must learn to lose your life to find it. We are willingly destroying here. We are willingly dying. Something is leaving. We have to get used to that feeling of giving up, of relinquishment. And when we've died, there is nothing to do. That's true, both of our physical death and also of this metaphorical death. This death of ourselves that we practice here. There is nothing to do. Can you feel that? Can you feel what it's like to have absolutely nothing to do? That's ease. And to the extent that we can dwell in that feeling, that's dwelling in ease, as he says. And then we can do this miraculous activity of walking, of chanting and just chanting, of just eating. And that's the way in the Zen school that we learn to be in closer harmony with our own lives, with all of the things in our lives. We start with this very simple practice of letting everything go and just inhabiting these simple activities. And then when we encounter more complicated activities, we try our best with those because we've learned how to do them with these simpler activities. And I think that I think that that's what the Buddha wanted us to do, and I think he believed that it's within everybody's reach to find that place with nothing to do when we had nothing to do. It takes time, it takes effort, it takes diligence and patience. But when we get there, he says, when we get the real innermost meaning of this, when we feel it, an iron boat floats upon the water. Well, there's another miracle. I don't know what he means by that. But the feeling I have is that which seems so heavy, that which seems so stuck and solid, floats. Floats up. That buoyancy comes little by little in this practice. That feeling of buoyancy in our life and in our person. And by doing the Buddha's present moment awareness with the littlest things, with opening a door, with touching a teacup to your lips, walking to and from your cabin. I really want to ask you to make a special effort to notice those things, those little things. Lemon Pan calls them, you know, chopping wood and carrying water. But whatever you do during this retreat, please take some special notice of it, of the bag that is your body. And see if you can't do those things in a way with ease, as if you have nothing else to do but just this thing. It's a good practice. And it's helped along, of course, by the practice of everybody else here. Thank you for doing that practice. Thank you for applying yourself diligently and with patience. And let's keep going.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.